This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts.
This is where the healing begins.
And now, Kim Cotola and Cradle My Heart Radio.
This is Cradle My Heart Radio, and so glad that you have tuned in. We need you week in and week out, and you are the reason why we are here. And I know that sometimes it's really tough listen. I understand that. The topics that we get into, sometimes we try not to be graphic. We try not to be provocative. But sometimes the issues that we discuss are just difficult in and of themselves. And tonight, that's going to be the case. But we bring you this update on the Gosnell movie for a couple of very important reasons. The Gosnell movie seeks to bring to light the evil done by an abortionist named Kermit Gosnell, who is now serving time in prison without possibility of parole because of his role in killing children as well as his patients at his clinic in Pennsylvania. He was convicted in 2013. The media told his story when they deigned to look at it. The media chose to look away when the case was being tried. The media put a blackout on the story until a couple of brave journalists called attention to the fact that this was a serial killer. This was a mass murderer. He was being charged with felony counts of murder for the lives of 8 separate individuals. And why was the media not paying attention? Well, Anne McElhaney was paying attention. She and her husband, Fela McAleer, are filmmakers, documentarians, as well as telling a story in the form of a story. And that's the approach that they have taken with the Gosnell movie. They're making it as a television movie, which will tell the story in terms of a drama about America's biggest serial killer. In doing the research, Anne had the opportunity to go and meet Kermit Gosnell behind bars, and we talked about that with her recently. Here's our conversation with Anne McElhaney. And Anne, it's so nice to welcome you back to Cradle My Heart Radio. Thanks for joining us again today.
It's great to be here, Kim.
One of the things we want to talk about today, the invitation today, is about your meeting with Kermit Gosnell. You went inside the prison to sit down with him, and I can't imagine what that was like. I just want to give you the chance to describe that for us and tell us what happened.
Unbelievable. Exactly as you can imagine, Kim. Just really very shocking and chilling, bone-curdling, and all those kind of words. I mean, I think it took us, you know, more than a week to get over it. He is extremely relaxed. He smiles all the time. Completely convinced of his innocence, and says things that, I mean, your audience will so understand this, talks so nicely about his wonderful, wonderful friend, George Tiller, the abortion doctor from Kansas, who he described as a wonderful human being. He has an answer for everything. I mean, when you think of a normal human being in prison for the rest of their lives with no prospect of ever being free again, you can imagine the person would be at least, you know, downhearted or bleak or sad or depressed. None of those words apply to Kermit Gosnell. He is extremely happy. He's reading a lot, listening to music, taking lots of exercise. And, you know, we sat in a room with him. It was an open room. I had always this idea that I would be behind plexiglass or some kind of, you know, I'd be speaking on a phone. Not at all. It was an open room. Other inmates were there with their loved ones. He sat far too close in my personal space, and I had nowhere to go because I was right up against a wall and had his legs on both sides of my legs. Mm. So I was really trapped, and then touched my leg continuously. At one point he sang. He was explaining how much he loved the music of Jacques Brel, who's a very famous French kind of romantic singer, and couldn't remember the name of the famous Jacques Brel song, which I reminded him was Je ne quitte pas, Don't Ever Leave Me. And then he started singing that to me in French. So it's chilling. And I asked him very direct questions, very hard questions about why did he redo the ultrasounds. you know, for example, that was one question that I asked him, and, you know, he said, you know, he would, every now and again, he'd say, oh, you know about that. And then he would just lie. He just lied all the time. He lied about the Mother's Day massacre. He lied about absolutely everything that he did, and spoke about himself as if he were a god, as if he were, you know, a superhuman kind of person. Spoke about how ridiculously intelligent he was, much more intelligent than normal people, you know, because I was trying to pin him down on the ultrasounds, and he said, well, you see, the problem is, you know, most people just don't understand mathematics. But I've never met anyone quite like him.
The point there is that he was altering the dates of women to skirt the law as to when he could or could not be performing abortions after 24 weeks.
Correct. What he would do is, and one of the people who took to the stand, in fact, one of his patients, was handed her own medical file and had to go through it, where there were three separate ultrasounds for the same, you know, for the same pregnancy, for the same baby. And what he would do was, you know, because initially he would do the ultrasound and it might be 30 weeks or 31 weeks or more. And if you manipulate the ultrasound, you can make the baby look smaller. And so he would do that. And so that woman, who was, I think, 31 weeks pregnant, you know, eventually they managed it down to 24 weeks, which is legal in Pennsylvania. And this is what he did all the time. And, of course, there is no explanation for him redoing ultrasounds. And all of the staff, when they took to the stand, all of them said this is the reason that he redid the ultrasounds, was until he got the number he wanted. And at one stage, I was really pinning him down on that, and he was basically saying, then he switches gears very quickly. He's very plausible. He's very, it's the banality of evil is how I kind of described it.
Mm-hmm.
But he said at one stage, you know, well, I'm really good at my hands. And he sort of shows these hands that he has. He has really large hands. He has really large feet. And he shows these hands. Well, I'm really good at my hands. You know, I really don't need an ultrasound at all to tell what the age of the baby is. He's just extraordinary. I mean, he really would. He took my breath away, to be honest with you. I have never been in the presence of evil to that extent before. I've met some really bad people, but this is a totally different situation.
And what do you think his purpose is in invading your space? Is that to take control of the interview? Is that to intimidate you? Is it because he thinks he's charming? I mean, what do you think was going on with that?
I think all of the above, actually. I think you've got a very good sense of it from what you're saying. I think, and I know from interviewing people who worked for him and from patients that I've interviewed, that he likes to wield power. So he definitely had me pinned to the wall, basically. And I think that whole, you know, casual touching of my leg continuously and then apologizing was just kind of, you know, marking territory or whatever. And I think that's exactly the kind of person he is. I think he has this God complex, which you can understand in some ways. You know, here he was murdering in plain sight for years, and the Department of Health in Pennsylvania let him away with it. The governor of Pennsylvania let him away with it. The Department of State let him away with it. The police let him away with it. You know, no one crossed the threshold, you know, in almost 20 years. You know, this is, of course he felt invincible. And so he continues to have that demeanor of power and, but every now and again, you know, the demeanor, there's a crack in the demeanor where he kind of says, oh, you know about that. And then he just starts lying. He just lies about everything.
So he,
has this kind of plausibility. It is incredible to me, the kind of person that he is. It's incredible, but it all kind of makes sense. He was God in his own territory. He decided life and death, and he did it banally.
Right.
He did it with complete banality.
And then when he's called to account, he's just a misunderstood genius, and you just don't get it.
That is absolutely right. Yeah, you're a little person with a small brain. You couldn't possibly understand the kind of work that I do, how I help people, how I help the poor, how I could have worked. I mean, and he has this whole extraordinary arrogance, impenetrable arrogance. I could have been this, and I could have been that. Instead of that, I worked with these, basically, and he actually is quite insulting about them, you know. I kind of worked with the little people. I worked with these awful poor people from these minorities. And, of course, he himself is African-American, but he kind of has a disparaging attitude to minorities. I worked with them. I could have been in Stanford. I could have been in Berkeley. I could have been in New York, but no, I went back and worked with black people. You know, he's just extraordinary. And of course, I think the reason that he did work in the communities he worked in was because a lot of people, you know, didn't have the advantages he had had in life, and so he could lord it over them.
Sure.
It made him feel, you know, bigger about himself. If he'd actually been working a lot more with peers, you know, they wouldn't have listened to this nonsense.
Well, Anne, I know that you are not producing a documentary, so I'm wondering if this footage is something that you're going to release or if this is on background and research for the project, because the Gosnell movie is a dramatization. It's a true it's a true crime story, right?
Yeah.
Tell
no,
us how
we weren't allowed to film, so we just took notes. But I think the reason we really did it was for background. Also, we're writing a book about Gosnell, and we're using it for that. But I think it was really important also for the film to know for sure that we have him right, that we have the character correctly portrayed in the film, and we have him spot on. You know, as a man who talks about Chopin, talks about his hands, talks about his feet all the time, about how much exercise he's taking, and while we're having a conversation about dead babies, this is who it is. This is who this guy is. This is this man, and he's. We were very reassured that we have him spot on in the script, so we feel good about that. This is an important story. It's you know, every day that we work on it, we become more and more convinced of how essential this is, that this is told, because if there was one Gosnell, and we know there is one Gosnell, there's no doubt about it. What happened with him and with the Department of State and the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, there's no way that that's not happening in other parts of the country, where the law enforcement and where the Departments of Health and local government treat abortion clinics differently than they treat other health outlets. And because of their different treatment of that, there is murder and mayhem. That's what I think.
Anne McElhenney from the Gosnell movie. We've got links at cradlemyheart.org so you can find out more about the project. Anne, tell us about the timeline and when we can expect to see this film.
We're hoping to film, you know, August, September. We're in the casting process right now, but we would love support. We still need lots of support. We have a very small budget for this really large film. At this point, we're asking for lots of donors. We need more donors, not big donors. We need small donors. We want people to give us $1 at gosnellmovie.com. The number of people is nearly 28,000 people now. We'd like it to be 100,000. It should be 100,000. And if anyone's listening and thinks I have no money, give me $1 and get everyone you know to give me $1. Because when we're trying to get distribution in this town, Hollywood, and you know what that town is like in terms of subjects like this, the strength of the numbers will open all the doors. And it's incredibly important that people give us $1 and get their church to give us $1 and their prayer group to give us $1. $1 from everyone, it's a massive voice. It sends such a powerful message.
Well, I'm a donor, a full disclosure, and I can't wait to see it. And
if you are
inspired and you'd like to know more, we've got a link where you can learn about how to donate as well. Anne, thank you so much for being with us for the update on the Gosnell movie.
Take care.
Here at the press conference following the Selma Project for Life march across the Pettus Bridge, Dr. Freda Bush was one of the speakers at the conference and also at the rally the night before. And Dr. Bush, first of all, I'd like you to talk about your connections with the bodies that are licensing medical professionals, because when you spoke last night at the rally about who really is performing abortions in America, to me it was quite opening. So talk about these groups that you're involved with that are involved with licensing medical professionals.
I am here representing the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs.
Okay.
And this is a professional organization that's made up of OBGYNs, board certified, as well as family practice and other health professionals who are really trying to get the truth out, information about what an abortion is, not only that, some of the complications that are being whitewashed, if you would, and also informing and educating the health professionals that are out there to care for women in a proper way. I am history of being on the medical licensure board for 12 years in Mississippi, as well as serving with the Federation of State Medical Boards of the United States. So I'm well familiar with what the rules and regulations are to govern physicians, and we work through the states. So basically, we set the standards, are part of setting standards for licensing of physicians, what requirements are needed, what tests are taken, what level of professionalism that they should have in order to provide good care.
Sure. And so part of your remarks last night included the fact that when these standards are not upheld, the victimization of women is a result. I was surprised to hear how many people who are performing abortions are not medical professional, or they're not medical doctors, they're not MDs, they're not obstetric gynecological professionals, they're not doctors. Tell me about who is performing abortions in America today.
Who is performing abortions in America today is anyone who wants to. They must be a health professional. But the point I was trying to make also last night is the medical licensure boards license the physicians, but they don't go out looking to see who is upholding the standards that they had to have in order to get a license. The medical licensure boards are dependent upon reporting. Someone got hurt or someone has a concern, then the medical licensure board will investigate. But if they don't get a concern expressed, then they don't know you're out there not performing as you did when you initially received your license. So part of my appeal last night was to encourage women and those who've been hurt to report to the licensure board. Your licensure board is only as good as the reports that come to them. Then it is their responsibility to investigate, and then the licensure board to determine what is needed. Is it remediation or is it revocation? Do we take his license or do we help prepare him or her to perform as they should and make those recommendations? So I'm encouraging everyone to report to the licensure boards any concern that you have, any egregious event that has occurred. And as far as the licensed physicians or the nursing board, if it is a nurse or nurse practitioner, I'm asking them also to report to the Department of Health for the clinic itself. Abortion is an outpatient surgical procedure. Whether you have a medical abortion or that may end up being a surgical abortion, or whether you have a surgical abortion. And there are rules and regulations that govern outpatient surgical procedures, outpatient surgical clinics. If you know you've been hurt or you know someone that's been hurt or you have concerns about the facility, cleanliness, structure, you need to report that to the Department of Health. So I'm just encouraging people, don't be timid. These women are being hurt, and you can do something about it.
I was very struck by the way in which you refuted this popular notion that abortion is safer than childbirth. That's a rhetorical device that people who advocate for abortion rights have been using for years, if not from the very beginning. We've heard from many of the guests on this program that that's just not so. But your point is, because there is no mandatory reporting mechanism, there's really no way to know. And, you know, as I started my research on my book and for my speaking, I realized it's almost impossible to find objective research on this, because even if you go to the Centers for Disease Control, you find that the states are, again, voluntarily reporting, and California, for example, doesn't report. So talk about this and why this should matter to the average consumer, that our government has not seen fit to provide any oversight of this billion-dollar industry affecting so many American women.
I wish I had an answer why our government has chosen to do this. And political correctness is the only thing that comes to mind. But in all other vital statistics, that is not the case. There are rules and regulations as to how they're to be reported. Births and deaths in a hospital have rules and regulations. But if there are complications related to abortion, they actually don't record the injury or the death according to the original event, which was abortion. But if the woman got infected, they'll record it as an infection. Or if the woman's bowel was injured as a result of the surgical procedure going through the uterus and entering her bowel, it's reported as a bowel injury. It's never said a bowel injury due to an abortion or an infection due to an abortion. It shows up as a bowel injury or an infection. If a woman dies, it's a death, let's say, from blood loss, not from abortion. If she commits suicide, there's no way to know that it was related to an abortion that she had a month ago or a year ago, because they don't record.
Well, and I imagine you've seen all of these situations that you've outlined in your practice as an OBGYN physician.
I have seen many women who have been hurt and maimed, and they do not tell. Sometimes I'm the only person or the first person that they've told that they've had an abortion. And sometimes they're unable to have children afterwards, or they have problems with premature delivery because their cervix, the opening to their womb, has been injured as a result of the abortion, and now it will not stay shut in order to allow the baby full development.
Mm.
It's tragic, the things that we hear.
You know, Dr. Bush, I know that you're a visionary as well, and I heard you speak at an event in Georgia a number of years ago, and you said something about the lack of unity in the pro-life movement that really stayed with me, and it has provided a plumb line for me in terms of covering this issue, covering this movement, covering some of the diversity of the movement. I'd like to give you a chance to speak to that.
I remember it well. My husband was in the Air Force. And one of the things that he always talked about was all the units in the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the National Guard, the Coast Guard, all worked together for a common goal, and that was to protect and serve the United States. So the Coast Guard doesn't work against the Air Force or the Army against the Navy, that they all join together. And so it grieved me in the pro-life community that we have not found that place of unity when we're all wanting the same thing. So I encouraged all parts of this army to fight together in a cohesive manner so that we can end this travesty in America.
Amen. And I think that, you know, when the hard cases come up, whether it would be about rape and incest or what's before the House and Senate right now, the 20-week ban, you know, these are affecting less than 1% of women who are actually seeking abortions. And yet these are the things that seem to fracture us the most. Again, just if you can give us your thoughts of leadership on how to in our hearts settle the hard cases.
One of the things we have to do is be concerned about all cases. And if we can look at the teenager who has been raped and see it important to come around her and support her and not encourage her to get an abortion, if we can see the 27-year-old who thought she was going to marry and the marriage fell off but now she's pregnant and she has no job, if we can help her find employment or come around her to get education, if we can help even the hard cases of rape, it doesn't matter. It's a woman who needs help, who has been victimized. It's a baby, regardless of how it came here. If we can see the clear, big picture, then what we can do is work together to provide the services that person needs for the mother's sake as well as the baby's sake. And when we value life, then all of us will be better for it. All of us will be better.
Amen. Great note to end on. Dr. Freda Bush, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I am so appreciative to Dr. Freda Bush being able to bring us the truth about abortion, to put it in context for us. As we think about her work in her medical practice, in the patient rooms where she deals with her patients and her clients over the course of 40 years, Dr. Bush has told me that she has seen the impact of abortion on the women who have chosen it. That's why she took part in the IC2 campaign. She said, "As a doctor, I was taught that when I cared for a pregnant woman, I cared for two, the woman and her unborn child. That's why IC2. Dr. Bush, in her role as a pro-life obstetrician and gynecologist, stands apart from many of her colleagues who would deny that that essential fact of science makes any difference whatsoever. Kim Cotola, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for joining us. And go to cradlemyheart.org if you'd like to know more about our guests and find links to their organization and also resources and timely articles in the news. cradlemyheart.org. Now stay tuned here at Faith Radio. We will continue the conversation about stories in the news that you need to know to advance the cause for life. I'm Kim Cotola, and this is Cradle My Heart Radio.
Safe place to connect with others, finding God's love after abortion. This is Cradle My Heart Radio.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken again, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
Cradle My Heart with Kim Cotola. Join the conversation. Call toll-free 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003.
Well, this is the Cradle My Heart Live portion of our radio show for this week, and so I'm glad that you're here. And, you know, if you don't ever listen to the very end of the program, you probably miss most of our callers because for whatever reason, it always takes folks a while to get a hold of the topic and get over to the phone and give us a call. But the last couple of weeks, we've had some amazing listener input. We talked about Jimmy Carter's comments on how Jesus wouldn't approve of abortion unless a woman had been raped. And I asked for your reaction to that comment. He said that during a Huffington Post interview a couple of weeks ago. We've got the article linked at cradlemyheart.org. And we had the most amazing phone call from a young man who shared a story of how his mother was a rape baby, as he put it. And he said, you know, you can't say one life has value over another. Doesn't matter that my grandmother was raped. He said, my three brothers and I just came to Christ. None of that would have happened if my mom weren't here. And then he went on to tell the rest of his story, including the fact that he was the result of a one-night stand. He said he grew up fatherless, which was a deep, deep pain in his heart. But years after grandmother's tragedy, his grandfather came and sought forgiveness and reconciliation and provided a father figure in the young man's life. His name was Celeste. He said only God can do these things. And he struck me as pretty young. I think he may have even said that he was in his 20s. Anyway, he then went on to try to set former President Carter straight about having also said he thought Jesus would approve of same-sex marriage. So it was quite the phone call. He was a really bold witness. And then last week, at the end of the program, we were talking about Planned Parenthood, and we were talking about their deceptive practices and all the things that have been in the news in the last couple of weeks with the video expose that's been going on. Two videos now released. There's more to come, we hear. And at the very end of the program, Ruth called, and we ran out of time. And I spoke with her off the air, and I invited her back on to share her story with you because, just like Celeste's story, we don't know how God plans to bring good out of the worst tragedies and the worst circumstances out of our lives. We just don't know. And Ruth's story, I think, really illustrates that. Ruth, thank you for coming back on and agreeing to share the story with the listeners tonight. How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. Thank you, Kim.
You know, I shared your story with so many people I came in contact with this week, and it was, it's such a heartwarming story. And so I want to give you the opportunity to share it, and I really want to tell you how much I appreciate it, because I'm sure it's not an easy story to share.
Well, you know, I feel so blessed to have, after 30 years, my son in my life, that, you know, I've shared with a lot more people than you might think. And also to illustrate to younger people what a blessing it is to have your child, regardless of your circumstances, regardless of what you do. If you keep your baby, if you decide to give your baby up for adoption, it is still a huge blessing to not have that guilt of giving in to the murderous practices of our society, and to not have that guilt on your conscience. You know, to have to deal with that for the rest of your life, is much more horrible.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, thank God that we have our merciful God, and we have our justification in Christ alone. But you turned to Planned Parenthood because you found yourself pregnant while still pursuing your education.
Yes, I graduated from high school in 1974 and became pregnant by the end of the summer, and really didn't have direction. I went to a horrible high school in a very big city, and you know, where teachers smoked pot, the kids smoked pot. We were all in it together. It was not a good situation. I did not know the Lord. I knew of Him because my parents were believers, but they had no idea what was going on in the schools or with the kids or anything. And when I found out I was pregnant, I was certain that this man that I had been with was not going to be a father of any child of mine, because I knew he was not responsible, not somebody I would want to raise a child. And I went to Planned Parenthood just out of desperation, and also to confirm that I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And a doctor told me that I would never have any kind of life if I had this baby, that I would never go to college, that my child would be impoverished, that we would basically not survive. If we survived well, you know, we would never survive well.
And so you're 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
But 18. Ruth, you don't scare easy, do you?
I was scared. I was. I thought about it. I knew it was wrong. I was like, God, will you forgive me if I do this? And I never felt that was, you know, I did not feel that I was getting an answer at the time. I think I was so distressed, and I didn't tell anybody, and my best friend had moved to Florida, and so there were no people around that I really felt comfortable talking to about this.
Sure.
And so, but long story short, I gave him up for adoption. And he was raised by people I would never have chosen. As it turned out, the agency at that time was a totally different scenario than what you find now. And they told these people that my son was a minority child because he was part Middle Eastern. One quarter. And these parents, I think, capitalized on that at times with him. But anyway, they were not who I would have chosen. However, he eventually ended up with a full scholarship to law school, and now he is a lawyer. I graduated from college, and all my insecurity about raising a boy, because I had had four younger sisters, was you know, blown away by God, who then led me to a career where I worked with boys for 14 years. So it was very interesting to me. I never understood that. I have a lot of questions for the Lord.
a lot of twists and turns, but here we are, we're smiling, and you're a mom. You know, you always were a mom, but you have this son. So now he came looking for you.
Yes. about 6 years ago. His wife had encouraged him to do that, and he said he wanted to fly up like right now from Florida to Minneapolis, and I met him at the airport. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I don't want to, I mean, how would you characterize your relationship with him? Because we've all heard stories of reunions. You know, I think we're coming to that the close of the era where all adoptions were closed, and so the reunions were extremely dramatic when we began to hear about them probably 5-10 years ago. Now I think enough reunions have happened that we hear the whole spectrum. Sometimes it's, you know, it was a great thing right away, and it's a wonderful relationship that's developed. Sometimes it's more difficult. How did things go for you?
Well, unknown to me, because this had always been a source of hurt for me for many, many years. I had two sisters of the four that I have that were praying diligently about this and were just praying that you know, he would surface. And so they were just super excited. He and his wife and my three grandchildren all attended a family reunion in the Southwest about 4 years ago, and he's part of my family. He's my joy. I talk to him 2 or 3 times a week at least, and I love my grandchildren, and I fly down there 3 or 4 times a year at least.
And Ruth, you never married.
No, I didn't. I didn't.
But you just said
it wasn't specifically to do with him, but no, I didn't.
Sure. But what I want people to catch is you just said you have 3 grandchildren.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
To me, this is the part of the story that is so dear, that you couldn't have foreseen when you made your decision to think your decision, Ruth, and what I'm hearing of your story is you decided to do the right thing. You were scared, but you decided to do the right thing. And then you could not have foreseen that, you know, there wasn't going to be a husband in your future. And yet here we are, and you have 3 grandchildren. It's such a beautiful story.
Well, I have 3 grandchildren. I have been mom to... probably at least, I don't know, 300, 400 kids over the years. Literally. I worked with kids in residential treatment, in a psychiatric facility, in children's detention. And I've done inner city ministry up until recently. That was about 12 years, where people always, you know, on Mother's Day would come to me and have all kinds of comments about me being the mother they didn't have.
Mm.
And,
you know, we've just got a couple of minutes in this segment. I want to give you the opportunity to speak directly to the person who may even be in a vulnerable position tonight listening or on the podcast whenever you happen to be hearing this. She's saying, I could never give a child for adoption, could never release my child for adoption. What would you say to this person who's vulnerable right now, tonight?
I'd say don't be afraid to do what God wants you to do. If you feel led to keep your child, there will be a way for you to get through. And if you feel that adoption is where God is leading you, there are, you know, with open adoption, the way that this works now, you have so many more options, and don't give in to the temptation to forego what is just 9 months. 9 months of your life goes very, very quickly in the larger scheme. You know, and God will redeem all of the things to you that you pray for. He will bless you with your child. You'll be able to have a relationship. But if your child is never born, you don't have that opportunity. and to have to ask for forgiveness instead of just that redemption is a problem that you can't solve until you are in heaven, until you see that child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm guessing
able to make that right now is it's something that you can't get back.
Mm, amen. I hope that anybody who needed to hear that, and especially you grandmothers, prospective grandmothers, women of influence in the next or the older generation, I hope you heard it too, as you're giving advice and as young people are looking to you for wisdom. Ruth, I really want to thank you for sharing the story, and I wouldn't presume to put words in your mouth, but I'm thinking that the years you got the opportunity to meet your son, actually, in the total scheme of things, maybe it went pretty quickly, too.
Yes. Yes, the Lord filled my life with unbelievable opportunities and people that no one else wanted, and it's been a privilege to serve them.
Thank you so much. What a blessing your story is. I really appreciate you sharing it with us tonight, Ruth.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
1-800-811-3003. What's your story? 1-800-811-3003. Cradle My Heart Radio. We'll take a short break, and then we're going to take a look at some of the news. Oh, there's so much to say. Join us with your story, your take on the news, whatever you'd like to talk about relating to the cause of life. 1-800-811-3003. Live tonight here on Cradle My Heart Radio.
Seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cotola. Call toll-free at 800-811-3003. Seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cotola. Call toll-free at 800-811-3003.
Thanks for being with us tonight. Phones are open at 800-811-3003. I'm Kim Cotola, your host. Would love to hear from you if you're inspired by Ruth's story or the story we shared from Celeste, who had called in a couple of weeks ago. Would love to hear your take. 800-811-3003. If you need prayer because you have not yet found the peace that comes after an abortion, call and we'll pray with you. I promise you, there are people listening to this program who will respond and call in and pray for you and with you. You don't have to give your name. The ground rules here say you may call anonymously. We would love to hear your story, share our heart with you, and allow us the privilege of prayer. 800-811-3003 is the phone number here at Cradle My Heart Radio. I mentioned the last couple of weeks that I was at Oklahoma Wesleyan University on campus for an applied bioethics certificate course, and we completed the coursework. We've got to do some papers and a lot of work still between now and the first week in August. And it's been really rigorous with a lot of reading and, oh my goodness, our logical facilities have really been stretched, especially as Dr. Mark Newman helped us learn to do how the public speaking side of it after Scott Klusendorf had gotten us grounded in the pro-life worldview. And Mark had a great post on his Facebook page today. He was writing in response to Hillary Clinton defending Planned Parenthood. And, you know, if anyone would have told me at the beginning of the week that the Obama administration would bring the force of the Department of Justice to bear on the person who is responsible for the expose instead of investigating an organization that's trading in human body parts, I would have said, you can't tell me that's true and you can't make that up. But that's the way it went this week. And after the Obama administration stepped up and after a few things happened, then the supporters slowly started coming out of the woodwork. They really weren't there after the initial release of that first visit. But Hillary Clinton said, I think it's unfortunate that Planned Parenthood had been the object of such concerted attacks for so many years. And it's really an attack against women's right to choose to make the most personal, difficult decisions that any woman would face based on her faith and her medical advice that she is given. And so Mark Newman has three questions for Hillary. He says, first, can Hillary tell the difference between an exposé and an attack? And he writes, here's a hint. Planned Parenthood attacks unborn human beings every day. Not a metaphor. Their victims actually die. His second question, if the unborn are not human beings, but just nondescript tissue, why is the decision to abort difficult? And then finally, if the unborn are human persons and Planned Parenthood kills them and harvests their organs for sale, why would she support them? 1-800-811-3003. These are all good questions. And Russ Duthat had a great piece in the New York Times today writing about, you know, the logic of all of this. And if you just, you know, if you go to the comment section at the New York Times website, it's an incredible thing to me that not only are people following the non-logic of Hillary Clinton, because really that question is not meant to be snarky. It's a valid question. Anyone who says, look, women need the right to make a difficult decision, wait a minute. If there's not another life involved, why should it be difficult? If this isn't a human being, what is the problem? Why is it difficult? You know, I've never gotten an answer for that question. 800-811-3003. But Russ Duthat makes the point that, you know, a lot of people are looking away, including all of those now who are blaming the people who put out the videos, and, you know, a lot of people looking away from the evidence that's being presented here. And I'll tell you what, just scrolling through, there were over 1,000 comments early in the day today when I saw the op-ed on the New York Times website. But just, and I'm sure this is representative, you know, they're paragraphs long, but here's the logic of people who are answering this, okay, that were answering, look, if there's nothing wrong, why are we all looking away, right? So some people were reasoning, well, Planned Parenthood does good. They help me out with my birth control pills. Therefore, Planned Parenthood is good, completely bypassing the issue at hand. Another commenter said, you know, some of these children, if they are born, would suffer. Therefore, abortion is good. I mean, do we even need to try to break down the logic of that? Then you have the people who just throw out a non sequitur. Guns kill people, so you should be against guns, not abortion. Trying to conflate controversies that, oh, God kills, so we can too. So this person talked about, you know, the fact that nature, in nature, there are spontaneous miscarriages, and many, many of them. It probably, and I think this is probably true, there may be as many spontaneous miscarriages as elective abortions in any given year, given how frequent elective abortion has become. So maybe you've heard this. God kills, so we can too. Of course, they would never put it that way. They would simply say, it's natural, so what's your problem? But that's what they're really saying. Because usually this is a person who has a beef with God or says they don't believe in God. And this person, this commenter on the New York Times website today, compared zygotes to zinnia seeds. And I thought, oh, you know what? I would not have known what to say to this person before my week studying applied bioethics. But there's an answer to that. And their logic is flawed. The thing that makes a zygote different from a zinnia seed is that a zygote is a complete, distinct, whole, and living human being. You see, there's a seed in the male sperm, and there's the egg in the female ovum, but once they unite into a zygote, that creates a new human being, not a seed. The person who said that zygotes are like zinnia seeds is confusing parts with wholes. And you see, once you become a human being, you remain the same human being throughout your life. You don't become more of a human being as you grow and develop. The only differences between you today listening to me and the zygote you once were are your size, your level of development, your environment, and your degree of dependency. And we could talk more about that in the coming week. But, wow, just go to cradlemyheart.org we've got some articles posted about helping you think this through. Because that's what I really want you to do. If you've been hurt by abortion and you know the truth in your heart that a life was lost and you had a hand in it and you're broken over that, you'll find help there too at cradlemyheart.org. But boy, if you're just confused and you just don't know what to think, please keep listening. Go to the website and click on our links, because don't take my word for it. I've got so many experts there who can help you understand the truth of what I'm telling you, not only from God's Word, but from science and from some of the best minds thinking these things through for us in the world of philosophy today, too. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. I really appreciate you listening. We've got some great guests coming up in the future. In fact, Scott Klusendorf is going to be joining us. We'll have Father Frank Pavone from Priests for Life and many others coming up in the coming weeks. If you want to get in touch with us, join us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter. And the best way to link up with that, again, is through our main website at cradlemyheart.org. You'll find an email form there. And believe me, we will keep your contact confidential. We'd love to hear from you, too. Kim Cattola, thanks so much for listening.